Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue with our series Specialized Knowledge and Abilities. In our last series, we looked at some serious indications of an international connection to the Oklahoma City bombing, specifically the possibility that some German Nazi elements and perhaps others were connected to the fascist milieu that appears to have been involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. As I have indicated, I think the political rhetoric on all sides thus far has been inadequate vis-a-vis Oklahoma City, with the mainstream press and the government and the so-called progressive sector, please note the use of the term so-called, saying it was the militias or it was the right wing. And in turn, the militias and the so-called Patriots networks, again note the use of the term so-called, as well as the conspiracy crowd, have been saying it was the government. My own feeling is that there were some elements, please note the use of the term elements of the government, as well as elements, please note the use of the term elements, of the militias and Patriots networks involved in Oklahoma City. I think fascist elements in each of those respective entities were involved and were in cahoots with each other. We have also looked in our last segment at the mysterious John Doe number 2, one of the reasons why I suspect the government is not being forthright about all they know vis-a-vis Oklahoma City. I have suspected from the get-go that the logistics involved in Oklahoma City were too great for simply two individuals to have pulled that crime off. And also bear in mind that Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh, the two people charged in Oklahoma City, and Mr. Fortier, the informant who will be testifying against them, were all members of the same military unit previously, and that McVeigh actually went through Fort Bragg at one time. Again, bear in mind the Specialized Knowledge and Abilities title of this series. It refers to a Nazi tactic of infiltrating the police and military in order to acquire those abilities, in order to, in turn, formally overthrow the state. We have also looked at the tactic that Nazi groups on both sides of the Atlantic have been using of denying that they have in fact performed the very crimes that they have performed. And for those people who would be inclined to dismiss the possibility of complicity on the part of elements of the militias, bear in mind what we looked at in our Sons of the Gestapo series at a recent militia convention sometime before the derailing of the Amtrak train in Arizona in October of 1995. The militias were being encouraged to track the timing and scheduling of all Amtrak trains, and there is no conceivable innocent motive for doing something like that. I would also note in the cryptic coded communications in the Resistor, under the publication of the Special Forces Underground, there was a reference to the Model Trestle Railroad Club or something of that kind. I don't know what significance, if any, that might have, but I would not entirely dismiss the possibility that may have alluded to railroad sabotage. I'm not saying that is the case. However, I think it's a possibility that should not be too readily dismissed. Trains, by the way, are relatively easy to sabotage. And again, please note that fascist and Nazi elements are trained to deny that they have committed the crimes that they actually committed. And note again the long-standing fascist tactic of organizing along small underground cells to infiltrate various organizations, including police and military. And bear in mind, again, the title of this particular series. What we're going to do next is to take a look at what, for my money, is the most intelligent article that I have seen personally about the militia movement. We're going to examine a number of different facets of the militia movement, and we're going to be examining some aspects of the Oklahoma City bombing. Again, I think the political rhetoric on all sides has been inadequate. The paramilitary right is generally a mixed bag. Many of them are outright raving fascists and Nazis. Many of them are also sincere, although badly misinformed, conservatives. I think that the question has yet to be properly asked vis-a-vis the militia movement over whether perhaps the militias themselves or significant elements thereof, please note my use of the term elements, might actually be a de facto extension of the very government that they are professing themselves to be opposed to. And this is just not something that has been properly dealt with, in my opinion. However, those very important questions were, in fact, raised in the High Times issue of November of 1995. High Times, by the way, is a marijuana advocacy publication. I guess this particular article, as well as some other fine articles that have appeared dealing with straight journalism, I guess one could say, are proof of the old term that even a blind pig finds an acorn once in a while. And a research credit and a major tip of the hat to a listener who dug this particular article up for me. This article is from the High Times issue of November of 1995. It's by Bill Weinberg, W-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, and it is entitled, appropriately enough, "The Militia Movement, Enemy or Pawn of the State?" And it raises, even in the title, or in the subtitle, the very question that I think needs to be asked. The article then contains the following additional subhead. "The militias have hit the mainstream media since April's cataclysmic explosion at the Oklahoma City Federal Building. This homegrown paramilitary movement apparently thinks the federal government is the devil. But some militia leaders are closely connected to neo-Nazis, corporate power, and even ultra-elite federal spook agencies." And again, I think that as I've indicated, and we will develop this further in this series, I think the militia movement in many ways parallels the development of the national Bolshevist philosophy in Weimar Germany. By the way, that has nothing whatsoever to do with communism any more than National Socialism or Nazism has to do with socialism. Rather, it is a right-wing grassroots revolutionary philosophy, which ultimately manifested itself in the Gregor Strasser wing of the early Nazi Party, which, by the way, was liquidated after the Nazi Party came to power. And I think that those sincere conservatives within the militia movement are very likely to experience a similar fate after the formal ascension of fascism in this country as well. And again, I think this article asks the most important question and indicates that, in fact, there are some disturbing indications that rather than being enemies of the state, at least some elements of the militias, if not most of them, and I think many of them fall into this category, are in fact extensions of the very state that they represent themselves as being opposed to. And again, for the record, I think that Oklahoma City and other acts of fascist terror in this country involve a cooperative pattern between fascist elements within the militias and fascist elements within the government, although not necessarily all or even most of each, at least as far as we have proof of so far. But for those who would attribute Oklahoma City solely to the militias or the right wing, how about John Doe number two? And why haven't people been talking about the apparent European connections to same? And for those who would attribute the Oklahoma City bombing and other things to the government, quote unquote, there are some very serious questions to be raised about why, for example, militia groups are going to track Amtrak trains. And indeed, as we examine the newsletter of the militia of Montana prior to Oklahoma City, I think there's some very serious questions to be raised for those who would attribute this crime solely to the government. We're going to begin with the first installment of our reading of "The Militia Movement, Enemy or Pawn of the State?" by Bill Weinberg, from High Times of November of 1995. And the article begins with a very interesting quote, "You'd better watch the shadows, because they're all watching you." That attributed to somebody named Tonio, T-O-N-I-O-K, period. Not a name I'm familiar with. The article begins, "Since the cataclysmic April 19th blast at the Oklahoma City Federal Building, which left over 150 dead, the media have finally started to focus on the rapidly growing militia movement. Now organizing in some 20 states around the country, this homespun paramilitary movement apparently stands for local rule and thinks the federal government is the pawn of a United Nations conspiracy to take over America. But in this era of free trade and radical industry deregulation, the militia agenda actually reflects much of the rhetoric and political programs which are issuing from Washington." Amen, I would interject. Continuing, "Lines are being drawn, and the American political spectrum metamorphoses in paradoxical ways. Conservative Republicans play to populism, while liberal Democrats call for draconian police powers. Are we between the Scylla and Charybdis of terrorism and martial law?" The next segment is entitled, "Oklahoma City, Forgotten Facts and Unanswered Questions." As Malcolm X said about the JFK assassination, the Oklahoma City bombing was a case of the chickens coming home to roost, most obviously for the 1995 FBI-ATF raid on the Branch Davidian compound at Waco, Texas. It was after Waco that the militia movement exploded across the country, with many in Middle America coming to see the federal government as the enemy of their cherished gun and property rights. Interrupting, as I've indicated, I think that Waco was a domestic intelligence operation. The Justice Department officials overseeing that were Bush holdovers. Clinton had just gotten into office, and in fact, many of them were Bush holdovers that were involved with the interagency governmental networks that arose out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. As we've seen in past broadcasts, those interagency governmental networks, I should say, eventually evolved into George Bush's private intelligence force. Bush, of course, vice president, later president, former director of the CIA, and it was those networks that were used to circumvent legal and constitutional authority in order to effect the weapons transfers for both the Contra support effort and the Iranian arms transfers in the Iran-Contra scandal, as well as the clandestine arming of Iraq that eventually became the Iraqgate scandal. Continuing. And so before I leave that topic, bear in mind my own hypothesis. I believe Waco was a domestic intelligence operation intended to discredit and destabilize Bill Clinton and to provoke the very kind of response that it ultimately did. And again, I think Bill Weinberg is raising a very important question here. The militia movement, is it an enemy or is it in fact a pawn of the state? Continuing. Less obviously, let me resume with the last sentence. It was after Waco that the militia movement exploded across the country, with many in Middle America coming to see the federal government as the enemy of their cherished gun and property rights. Less obviously, chickens were coming home to roost for Operation Desert Storm and the Reign of Terror implemented by the Pentagon and CIA in Central America throughout the 1980s. Accused Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh is a veteran of Desert Storm. He participated in the incident in which Iraqi troops in Kuwait were buried alive en masse by U.S. military vehicles. McVeigh was also trained at the U.S. Army's School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, notorious in Latin America for training local masterminds of massacre and torture. If McVeigh is guilty, we owe the monstrous insensitivity to human life to Uncle Sam. He reportedly aspired to join and was bitterly disappointed when he failed to make the Special Forces, the Army's elite Green Beret troops, who work closely with the CIA and death squad regimes such as those in Guatemala and El Salvador. Bear in mind again the Special Forces Underground and its resistor publication that we have dealt with in the past. Continuing, McVeigh was picked up for driving without license plates as he fled Oklahoma City. Refusing to use plates even in a getaway situation in which a police stop could and did prove fatal is the mark of a truly fanatical right-wing anarchist. In the ensuing days, it came to light that McVeigh and his presumed co-conspirator, Terry Nichols, had connections to the Michigan Militia. Founded in 1994, the Michigan Militia is among the largest in the country. The group's political guru, Mark from Michigan, a.k.a. Mark Kornke, a janitor who calls himself an intelligence analyst, claims to be a veteran of Army intelligence, is a favorite on the far-right video, shortwave radio, and lecture circuit. The group's leaders denied knowing anything about McVeigh or Nichols. Federal investigators alleged both men were involved in illegal gun dealing to the Michigan Militia. On April 24th, New York Newsday reported Kornke had sent a fax to Representative Steve Stockman, a Texas Republican on Newt Gingrich's firearms task force, about an hour after the explosion. Quote, "Bomb threat received last week," unquote, the note read. Again quoting, "Perpetrator unknown at this time," unquote. The word, quote, "Oklahoma," unquote, was underlined below. Stockman said his staff threw out the note, then fished it out of the trash after learning of the blast. Quote, "We want to know what was Kornke's source of information," unquote, a federal investigator said. But the investigator denied initial press accounts that the facts had actually arrived minutes before the bombing. And again, I would note that militia elements in Michigan, or in Arizona, rather, as we saw in our Sons of the Gestapo series, claim to have had forewarning about an incident prior to the Amtrak derailing. They may have, in fact, had a forewarning of government operations. However, I also hold open the distinct possibility. In fact, I think it's a probability that that, quote, forewarning, unquote, was in fact intended to mask the complicity of some of those very same elements with some elements of the government in that and other acts of right-wing terror. Bear in mind what Ingo Hasselbalch has pointed out, that Nazi and fascist elements are highly trained in denying that they perpetrated the very acts that they have in fact perpetrated. Continuing, Kornke, wanted for questioning, disappeared into the woods of Michigan. I would add that he has been relatively visible. As far as I know, he has not disappeared. Skipping down. Also quickly forgotten were initial media reports that Oklahoma State seismologists had detected not one, but two blasts at the federal building. The first at 4 seconds past 9:02, and then another of, quote, equal magnitude at 14 seconds after 9:02. Federal investigators now deny that there was a second explosion. Militia groups have produced propaganda seizing upon the two blast theory as evidence that McVeigh is an, quote, Oswald, unquote, i.e. a fall guy, and that the blast was an inside job, a government trick to justify martial law. By the way, I don't dismiss that possibility entirely. However, I think it's most likely that elements of the government, as I said, and elements of the militia were involved together, fascist elements of each. I will discuss a possible scenario with Oklahoma City and other acts of right-wing terror later on. This next segment of this particular article discusses elements of the militias that are explicitly aligned with fascist groups, including some apparent fascist elements within the militia of Montana. The March edition of Taking Aim, the newsletter of the militia of Montana, had issued a call to arms for April 19th, the day of the Oklahoma blast. And then it quotes from the newsletter, "If this does not ring a bell for you, then maybe this will jog your memory. April 19th, 1775, Lexington burned. April 19th, 1943, Warsaw burned. April 19th, 1992, the feds attempted to raid Randy Weaver. April 19th, 1993, the Branch Davidians burned. April 19th, 1995, Richard Snell will be executed unless we act now." Randy Weaver is the Idaho white separatist wanted on federal gun charges who got into an armed standoff with the FBI and ATF. The standoff climaxed in August of 1992 with the deaths of Weaver's wife and young son, as well as a U.S. Marshal. Richard Snell was the white separatist executed in Arkansas April 19th for the murders of a Texarkana pawnbroker, who he apparently thought was Jewish, and a black state trooper who had stopped him for a traffic violation. After the Oklahoma blast, a federal crackdown on the militias seemed imminent, but the feds backed down, and Tim McVeigh's connections to the militia movement have since been de-emphasized both by federal investigators and the media. The militias themselves have made certain concessions. The Michigan militia has officially disavowed Mark Kornke and reshuffled its leadership after its spokesman publicly alleged that the blast had been carried out by the Japanese in retribution for the gas attacks on the Tokyo subway, apparently believed to be the work of U.S. agents. Why did the Justice Department change course? Were 11th-hour deals cut between the federal government and militia leaders? Excellent question, and I think this is why I think this is the most intelligent, thoughtful article on the militias. It's asking the hard questions that need to be asked, because previously, as I've indicated, the rhetoric was, in my opinion, falsely dichotomized. Depending on which side you want, it was either the government or the militias. What people have not asked was that perhaps elements of the government and elements of the militias are in bed, and that elements of the militias might actually be an extension of elements of the government. And that, I think, is a very portentous possibility. The next segment of the article is called The Fascist Connection, Nazis in the Shadows. In 1988, 10 white separatist leaders across the country were arrested by federal authorities for their role in an alleged 1983 conspiracy to overthrow the U.S. government by force. The defendants included Richard Snell, who was already on death row in Arkansas, Richard Butler, chief of the Aryan Nation Central Compound at Hayden Lake, Idaho, Louis Beam, the federal Texas Klansman who was considered the Aryan Nation's, quote, ambassador at large, unquote. The Aryan Nation's calls for a secessionist white homeland in the Northwest Rockies. The group's coat of arms, proudly displayed at the Hayden Lake compound, is lifted from the insignia of a Nazi tank division. Federal prosecutors in the 88 trial claimed that the 83 plot, which included counterfeiting, armed robberies, and plans to assassinate federal judges and the Arkansas FBI chief, was to begin with the detonation of a truck bomb at the Oklahoma City Federal Building. Again, obviously, that is what happened in April of 1995. Continuing, all of the defendants were acquitted, but that very same building would be blown up on the very day of Snell's execution. Bear in mind, Richard Snell was a Nazi, and note his championing by the militia of Montana. Again, as I've indicated, I think the militias are something of a mixed bag. Many of them are not fascists and Nazis, but for those who would simply dismiss them as a bunch of loyal Boy Scout types, I think things like tracking their pronouncement of the necessity for tracking Amtrak trains, and things like the militia of Montana's newsletters championing of Richard Snell augur very large and have not been accounted for by the apologists for that movement. Continuing. Federal prosecutors in the 88 case based their claim on the testimony of James Ellison, founder of an Arkansas radical right group called The Covenant. He told of traveling to Oklahoma City with Snell to cause the federal building to case the federal building in preparation for the bombing. Ellison agreed to become a government witness because he was facing 20 years on racketeering charges. Before his capture in 1985, he had barricaded himself against 200 heavily armed state and federal agents at his northern Arkansas home. The day of the standoff was April 19th, 10 years to the day before the Oklahoma blast. We're going to talk more about James Ellison and his connections to elements that have whose names have surfaced in connection with the actual bombing of the building in a second. I would simply note in passing that as part of the Nazi ideology and part of fascist ideology, various mystical doctrines have been emerged in the past. Indeed, the core of the German Nazi Party under Hitler was a pan-German occult group. And I would also note that numerology is something that a lot of mystics adhere to, and the obsession with the date April 19th may in fact indicate a preoccupation with numerology on the part of fascist groups. I would also note, on the part of some of the fascist elements within the militias, I should say, I also want to jump ever so briefly to an op-ed column by Richard Cohen of the Washington Post in the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, October 18th of 1995. This is an op-ed column about Louis Farrakhan's speech at the Million Man March. Farrakhan in the past has been very chummy with white supremacist elements and, in fact, was an honored guest at a white supremacist conference in Michigan at the compound of Robert Miles. He's had dalliances with white supremacists in the past, as did his predecessor, Elijah Muhammad, one of whose funding sources was H.L. Hunt, the ultra-right-wing Texas billionaire. There have also been reports of connections between European Nazis and elements of the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam's Final Call has printed and distributed the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the notorious anti-Semitic forgery that was the basis of some of Hitler's doctrinaire anti-Semitism. And I would note the following, not necessarily significant and certainly not conclusive, but perhaps significant. This particular column is entitled 19, Oh Yeah, A Very Serious Number by Richard Cohen. I had been down to the Million Man March, talked to some people, and then ambled back to my office where I could watch the speeches in some comfort. About an hour after Louis Farrakhan's speech, I realized I was not where I wanted to be. I wanted to keep an eye on Jesse Jackson. In fact, I wanted to be in his head. I wanted to hear what he thought when Farrakhan returned, maybe for the third time, to the number 19 and its vast, although incomprehensible, importance. I wanted to hear what he thought when Farrakhan explained that the statues all around, those of Lincoln and Jefferson, were 19 feet high, and, get this, Jefferson was the third president and Lincoln the 16th, and that, my friends, added up to you-know-what. Quote, when you have a 9, you have a womb that is pregnant, unquote, Farrakhan explained, again quoting, and when you have a 1 standing by the 9, it means that there is something secret that has to be unfolded, unquote. It is my considered opinion, and perhaps we'll have time to go into this in a future segment, that Farrakhan and his Farrakhan is a black fascist, quite literally, and that his organization, the Nation of Islam, is a black fascist organization with a capital B, capital F, and capital O. I fully understand the appeal that Farrakhan's organization has for black Americans, just as I understand the appeal that Hitler had for downtrodden Germans in the 20s and 30s. Nonetheless, I think that Farrakhan's organization is dangerous. And I wonder, in light of his past dalliances and fascist inclinations, his past dalliances with white supremacists and the fascist inclinations of his group. And by the way, Farrakhan is one of the icons of the fascist third position that I've done archive shows about. I wonder whether this preoccupation with the number 19 is in fact indicative of something of an ideological cross-pollination between fascist elements within the militia movement and Farrakhan's organization itself. Not a possibility I would dismiss out of hand, although, again, it's only a possibility as far as I can tell. We're going to continue with our analysis of James Ellison and the fascist elements within the militias in our next segment. Now, I have alluded to the archive shows. The archive shows are a form of radio documentary that I've put together over the years in which the printed sources upon which the lines of argument presented on this program are based are excerpted on the air, literally extracted on the air so that listeners can tape the programs and use the resulting tapes as an audio study resource. More about, by the way, all of those tapes are on permanent file with a tape duplication service. More about those right now.
All of Dave Emery's archive shows are available from a tape duplication service named Archives on Audio. They can be contacted at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, zip code 94117-0023. The phone number is 415-346-1840. Again, Archives on Audio can be reached at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, 94117-0023. The phone number, 415-346-1840. There is also a catalog available which lists all of the archive shows, gives a synoptic description of each show, and cross-references the programs with other broadcasts containing similar or related material. The Archives on Audio catalog is available on the KFJC webpage, which is reached at http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC/Emery. Again, the website, all lowercase letters, is http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC/Emery. The website also has a suggested reading list and a list of other sources to pursue for more information on this field of research. Neither Dave Emery nor KFJC gets money from this arrangement.
By the way, on the KFJC webpage, there is also information about how to dial up the Germany Alert newsletter on the World Wide Web. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.